James Borton is a registered midwife who works in an NHS continuity of care midwifery model within Wales, UK. James describes himself as a home birth midwife experienced in physiological birth, working autonomously as a practitioner with the support of a small midwifery team. James is passionate about providing women and families with individualised care that works for them in a way that they can achieve positive outcomes during pregnancy, birth and beyond. James advocates for women to know and understand that they do have rights in birth, that they always have choices and that they can say no. James feels that a continuity of care model is the way forward in midwifery, or as he says, the way backwards, as this is how it always was, as the outcomes speak for themselves. In this episode, we shine a light on midwifery in a continuity of care service in Wales. We discuss with James about working as a midwife who gets to follow women and their families through the entire continuum, pregnancy to postpartum. James talks to us about their team's genius ideas to support midwives upskilling in the community setting. We found out that me, Katie, doesn't know what a B&B is. You'll have to listen to understand that one. We asked James about working as a male midwife, the importance of making strong relationships, midwife to woman, the joys of being the local midwife in the community, on calls and shift working within this midwifery model, the importance of students to get to experience this way of working. And we talk about the real magic of working in traditional midwifery. And James leaves us with a beautiful story of continuity of care from a midwife's perspective. This is the episode to start off the new year with a boost of oxytocin. A great episode if you're working within the maternity system, if you're a student midwife, or thinking of becoming a midwife. And for those of you deciding on what options are possibly available to you for your birth. Let's face it, this episode is one for all of us. So get the kettle boiling or tie up your laces for your walk and get ready for a re-lush episode in the cauldron. I'm Katie James and this is the Midwives Cauldron Podcast. Each episode I'm joined by my incredible co-host, Dr. Rachel Reed. Listen in as we hubble, bubble, toil and trouble our way through aspects of womanhood, midwifery, birth and lactation. So go on, subscribe now and hear us on your favourite podcast host. Good morning, good evening. Good morning, James Borton.
Morning.
If I said your name right.
You got it right.
It is a blooming pleasure to have you with us in the cauldron today. And I am very excited because I'm excited to talk birth and positive journeys and working within a system that seems to be functioning fantastically. So welcome to the cauldron with us.
Thank you so much. And I can't quite believe I'm here, but I'm very grateful to be here. And yeah, I'm looking forward to talking about how we work.
Fabulous. James, before we get started, can you tell our audience a little bit more about you and how you got into midwifery and where you are now?
Yeah, so I qualified as a midwife 14 years ago. And how I got into it was definitely more of a calling rather than, oh, that just seems like a good idea. I'll try and, you know, do midwifery as a job. It's just part of me. It's just, I remember being kind of like a child. This sounds really weird, but I don't know where it came from. But I remember being a child before I knew even how babies were born, and I would dream about being in the birth space.
Wow.
So it was like, it was just a calling. It's just what I had to do.
Wow.
But I did it the long way round. So I actually trained as a nurse first. And that wasn't ever because I, you know, wanted to be a nurse. It was just because at the time finances, you know, where I was in my life, and I had to do it that way around. So I trained as a nurse, got out of that very quickly because it just wasn't my thing at all. I literally scraped through the 3 years just to get through it. But I guess it gave me some background skills and stuff like that. It definitely helped me with my kind of people skills and things, and relationships building and stuff with people you don't know. But yeah, it just wasn't for me. Midwifery was always my calling. So yeah. And then I trained in Oxford in the UK. And I spent the first 6 months actually, let me backtrack. So when I did my training, I worked with a fantastic team of midwives just outside Oxfordshire, and they were kind of almost in the same sort of model as what I'm working now, except they were kind of associated with a bigger trust, and they were a community-based group of midwives, but their home birth rates were through the roof, their MLU birth rates were through the roof. So the first three births I ever witnessed were home births.
So lucky thing.
I was so lucky, honestly. And and I'm still in touch with my mentor now. She's the most amazing woman, and I've got so much to thank her for. And so that was kind of like my introduction to midwifery. And I remember then doing my first labor ward placement, and in Oxford it was a very kind of high risk labor ward. Lots of I don't know if they still do, but at that point they had quite an established fetal medicine unit, so we had quite a lot of referrals of women with very sick babies on board. That really kind of, I saw a lot of things that I still to this day will have flashbacks to, because it wasn't pleasant. And I just very quickly realized that I was not going to survive in that type of environment doing that type of midwifery. I don't mean that in the respect of what the midwives were doing. It was all the doctors. It was the situations. It was so kind of high risk. And when you're seeing time and time and time and time again these high risk situations, you start to get a bit like, God, does anybody ever just have a physiological birth?
Yeah.
Where are they, or what's going on? And I can see how your kind of vision can be blurred, if you like, from that perspective. And I wasn't living very close to Oxford at that time. I was about an hour's drive away. So I did my 6 months preceptorship there, which was probably the hardest 6 months of my life after I qualified, because, as I say, the environment I was working in, it was really difficult. I almost quit. But thankfully I managed to get a job close to home, which was still kind of, a general maternity system, but at least you were seeing a little bit more kind of broad spectrum physiology. It wasn't all about the really kind of high risk referrals and stuff. So then I went there and I did that for a couple of years, and just did a general kind of rotational post labor ward for 6 months, then an antenatal postnatal ward placement for 6 months. And I was, the women I were looking after there, I would do everything I could to optimize physiology, because they were a bit more amenable to it there. So I would be the one that would push the bed out the way, at this point there wasn't a birth center or anything. So this was, unless they had a home birth, this was the only place women came to give birth. And they got, it took them a while, but they got used to me, and they kind of, I remember there were certain labour ward coordinators that would say, oh, I'm just putting James right in the end room because he's just going to do his thing anyway. So, and that's what I would do. And it was great. But then they made plans to open an alongside midwifery led unit, so I was like, oh, I'm in there. So I was really lucky to be offered a job in there, and I was even more lucky to catch the first baby that was born in there. And that was just by absolute fluke. I just happened to be working the first shift after it had opened, and this woman came in and just pushed out a baby for me. So it was great. And that became a victim of its own success. I remember when it was being planned, nobody thought it was going to be successful, because, of course, at that point, all they were seeing on their on their board in the staff room on labour ward were women, you know, that were generally, or most of them were epiduralized, you know, most of them would have a forceps. They get like the odd multip that would push a baby out. But because again, they weren't seeing it, they just kept going, this is ridiculous. What a waste of staff. We're never gonna, you know, mm-hmm. need the birth center because nobody can have a physiological birth. But not unfortunately, it was good, but it was a victim of its own success. And I ended up quite burnt out, because I was, you know, catching 80 to 90 babies a year. So every shift, it was just like one after the other, after the other, which was really good.
Yes.
But because they didn't staff it properly initially, very quickly, I was like, birth was starting to become a bit blasé, because that's all I was doing. Mm. So I was like, great. So this isn't where I want to be, you know, really working. What else can I do? So then I went out to community and did like a mainstream community job where I was attached to a GP surgery, had, you know, quite a hefty caseload, you know, about 100-150 families at a time. And those, you know, 10-15 minute appointments where they would be in, out, and you wouldn't really get a chance to do anything other than a blood pressure. But the home birth rate was so low, probably about 2-3%, I think it was. And you were only on call maybe once a month, twice a month. So the chance of you actually, the few women that you would have on your caseload that were booked for home birth, the chance of you actually being there when they went into labour was next to nothing. And then postnatally, they were just dished out to whoever, you know, could see them on the day. So it was really task orientated care. So that frustrated me, and I was just kind of at the point where I was thinking, the only way I'm going to be out of work is independently. So because I wanted to do the whole spectrum, I knew I wanted to do that full kind of family orientated care where I would book somebody, I would look after them all the way through, I would attend the birth, and I would do all of their postnatal care. I just knew that that's what I needed to be doing. But I just couldn't find it. I was like, you know, the only thing I can do is go independent. And I did a little course with an independent midwife at the time to think about setting up my own business. And then the insurance went for independent midwives in the UK, so they were no longer able to do intrapartum care. So I was just, I was almost at the point of, that's it. I just can't, you know, I can't do this anymore. I can't find my niche where I want to work or what I want to do. And then I had a colleague who had been working where I, you know, was working at the time in the community, and she had moved to Wales. And she had come back to visit one day. It was all like it was meant to be. She'd come back to visit one day, and I was just catching up with her, and she said to me, oh my God, James, you would love where I'm working now. And I said, okay. And she told me all about it and the model of care and everything. And I was like, wow, this sounds amazing. So I did a bit of research and looked into it, and spoke to my partner, and as soon as the job came up, I went for it and I got it. So we moved all the way from Wiltshire in England to Wales.
Fantastic. That's a that big change.
7 years ago. Yeah, 7 years ago, and I haven't looked back. Great. So yeah, that's where I am now.
We'll be right back.
I just wanted to pop into your luggles and tell you about my brand spanking new podcast, The Feeding Couch. This podcast ain't just designed with pregnant women or new parents in mind, but also for all of us working in the space of birth work. This is the podcast where I hand the mic over to a different mom, dad, parent, or even grandparent to take us on their feeding journey. Every story matters. It's often through hearing others' experiences where we find our own inner knowledge, strength, and courage. Listen in to hear the stories told of triumph, challenge, heartwarming, tear-jerking, fist-pumping, and how we each deal with our venture into this new world emotionally, socially, and physically. Whether you're a student, a newbie midwife, doula, lactation exam prepper, or just hungry for more knowledge, these stories will also give you a backstage pass to the global lactation clinic. Whether you're pregnant and seeking information or supporting those on their journey, I can't wait to see you on the couch with me soon. Oh, and a little favour, your reviews on Apple Podcasts mean the world. They're like magic beans that help spread the podcast out for those who need to hear it. Let's make this something amazing together. And tell us a bit more about what's so different about the model that you're currently working in.
So how we work here is that we're completely midwifery led. So it's a service that covers around about 2,000 square miles.
Gosh.
Yeah, it's very rural. Mainly the main employment is agriculture. And it sits kind of like in the middle of Wales. And we've got, there are no obstetric units at all, no general hospitals at all within the whole county. So we're so that protects us as a midwifery led service. So we're completely midwifery led. So and we have six freestanding midwifery led units that are across the county. And in each midwifery led unit there is a small team of midwives, and we all together we make up, like, there's about, I think, 40 whole-time equivalents, and that includes our kind of management team as well. So in each birth center we've got between 4 to 6 midwives, so we're small teams, and in that birth center kind of caters for the geographical area around it, if you like. So, you know, each team covers a certain part of the whole county. And yeah, to get, if I, not that I ever have to, but if I were to, because I live right at the north of the county at the top, if I needed to travel down to the most southerly point, it would take me probably about 2 hours. That's because there's no motorways or anything, and that's just the roads and stuff like that. So that's the kind of like the vast kind of expanse that you're looking at. And then each midwife within the team holds a small kind of caseload of women. And for a full-time midwife, that's probably going to be no more than 35 to 40 women. And we're really lucky to be able to have small caseloads because the population is quite sparse. There's not a huge amount of people. And then the kind of childbearing age range, if you like, is even smaller, so that gives us the scope to be able to have, you know, the smaller caseloads, which are manageable. And it's a mixed, dare I say the word, risk, mixed complexity kind of caseload. So we obviously are looking after our midwifery led care clients, but we're also looking after our obstetric led clients as well. So for the obstetric led clients, they will choose which obstetric unit they want to be referred to. And wherever you are in our county, the nearest obstetric unit is about 35-40 miles away. So they're a fair distance. And I think we cover, I think it's about 12 different, I could be wrong, but I think it's about 12 different, you know, obstetric units around the county where the women could kind of, you know,
gosh,
go off to.
It's so big.
It's massive. For my team, we tend to refer out to 2, so it's not too bad. But all the paperwork's different. All of their guidelines are different. It depends on which one you're referring to. You've always got to think about, you know, what. And then, of course, what our guidelines are different as well. So it's challenging from that point of view.
Yeah, absolutely.
The good thing is, though, is that, you know, we have the same guidelines as all other, because we are NHS, so all other NHS health boards and trusts. But I think the difference is I could, you know, be booking a woman and she will tick a box for something. Let's say raise BMI, but I can have that individualized conversation with her about what that means for her as an individual rather than, okay, so you've ticked this box, you are at higher risk of this, 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 therefore you need to give birth in a labor ward, mm-hmm. or you need to see an obstetrician. It's not like that. I give her the information, she makes the decision about whether she wants that referral. And if she does, we go ahead and we do it. And I still work very closely with her through her pregnancy to ensure that all the information she's getting is kind of, you know, evidence-based, and it's holistic, it's individualized to her, so that by the time she does come to have a baby, she still understands that she has the absolute right to choose where she wants to give birth. Whether that be go to the obstetric unit, or whether she wants to come to our birth centre, or whether she wants to stay at home. And then I support her with that informed decision. So I think that's a massive difference, because I've got time. You know, I might book, it might take me two and a half hours to do a booking appointment, and I've got that time because
God, how lovely.
I can work from my own diary. So that's the other thing, is that we're not time restricted by anything. We're contracted, obviously, to work however many hours we're choosing to work, but how we work those hours is flexible. So, you know, like some days I will work 4 hours, others I will work 12. It just works around my caseload and what's going on in my life as well at the time. Because I also have a small holding, so I've got to like look after various forms of livestock and stuff like that. So if there's something going on here that I need to be around for, I will go and do my work a bit later, or, you know, I'll do my work early and then come home earlier. Or sometimes I'll do a bit in the morning, come home at lunchtime and go back off again. And we all work, you know, very autonomously in that way. And our management team are really, really good, because they give us that ownership of our diaries to work, you know, as we want to. And for some Amazing. Of my colleagues, if they've got little kiddies, they have to work 9 to 5, because that's just, and that's great. And we would, you know, the rest of us can work around them then, so that they can do that. Whereas others of us, like myself, need to work a bit more flexibly.
Fantastic. God, it's so lovely to hear that this can exist.
Yeah.
I'm just going to interrupt before, completely off topic. James, do you have another chair that doesn't squeak?
Oh.
Completely off topic.
Didn't even notice that.
I know, because that's because I'm a podcaster, isn't it? And I got it in my ear.
Hold on. I will.
Of all the things. Or
Katie might make you stand in the corner for the whole recording. Yes.
Can you please just squat? Hold your phone on one leg.
Yeah.
Oh, big one's coming out. I'm so sorry. I do this sometimes when I suddenly realise people have got jingly jangly jewellery on. And
I'm a bit lower. That's is that better?
Fine, we're not recording. We're not going to put video on. We haven't got to that point yet. 2023, we're still not doing video. Forget this. Nah, great, perfect. I'm sorry I interrupted the flight. I was like, I think this is the time. Rachel, I see you sitting there pensively. I'd have spoken. I just want to pause.
No, I was just thinking, it's like, you know, there's a template that works not just for the women and families, but works for the staff. Why is that? And it'll be cost effective. You know, it's, whenever the research looks at these continuity of care models, it comes out as cost effective, better outcomes. Women prefer it. Midwives prefer it. It's just frustrating. Oh, I'm going to go negative again now, Katie. It's just frustrating that can't be rolled out everywhere. It's like, you know.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, don't get me wrong. There are politics. Like there are some, you know, we have had quite recently a higher turnover of staff because some midwives have come in, they've had the, you know, they've looked into the service, they think, oh, amazing place to work, they've had the interview, they've got the job, but actually the reality of it is for them, with the on-call commitment and everything, they've really struggled.
Yeah.
And also really struggled with the enormity of the fact that we're so far away from obstetric support that the buck really does stop with us. If on the very rare occasion there is a deviation, we've got to deal with it, because we are looking at, the ambulance services are really struggling as well at the moment with staffing. So our ambulance wait times can be a little bit longer than average. And then the actual journey, even on blue lights, can take 45 minutes to an hour. Because of the distance of them. So I think for some people, they struggle with the enormity of that. But actually, you know, we've got really good kits. We're really well supplied and well stocked. We have really good, thorough obstetric emergency kind of updates, where we do it not in a hospital setting, because there's no point for us, because we're home birth midwives essentially. Mm-hmm. So we actually hire out a B&B 3 times a year. And
what's a B&B? Just for
bed and breakfast type place.
Yeah, oh, B&B. Sorry.
It's a very
thinking it was an acronym for some kind of like body something, like a device that I was like, oh, I don't know what that is. I do know what a B&B is. It's yes, know a bed and breakfast. Sorry.
So they are, we hire them out like 3 times a year, and we all kind of then, you know, a group of us will go there and we practice our kind of, you know, scenarios, and we set up all the bedrooms as like home births.
That's incredible. So, what a brilliant idea. Do you get a good breakfast as well?
Brilliant breakfast. It's amazing. we get to stay the night as well, so that's really good.
Oh, even better.
And it's all paid for by the health board. We don't obviously have to pay for that. It's all part of the budgeting and things, and that allows us to really practice. And we even get the paramedics involved. They come as well, and they're our local paramedics, so they're the ones that would be coming to us in those situations anyway, so we get to know them. And they sometimes bring an ambulance, so we do a little scenario in an ambulance or something, and it's just
someone wake you up at 3 a.m and make you do the drills then as well when you're
not
tired.
Not the draw a line
that is so brilliant. I mean, it's actually so simple, really.
It is
we do the training in the environment that we are going to be in.
Yeah.
Therefore, it's applicable, and therefore we can think in the same way that we would be thinking in someone's house or in the birth centre. It makes perfect sense. And going into a training centre held into a hospital or a university somewhere that feels completely out of place.
Yeah, it's it really helps to kind of give you the confidence and sets you up for, you know, if you come across those situations in real life.
Fabulous. It is music to my ears, really, hearing that there are models like this. And there are models like this, I imagine, in the rural areas of Britain that still exist. And it's just that having that continuity. I'm like you, I've worked in many different models. And when that continuity was taken away from me of carer, so not being able to be with the same woman, or it was just I'm in a place and I saw whoever came in, it for me was just I was losing a part of what I felt was being a midwife, which is it isn't just the birth as we know, it's everything that leads up to that. It's the whole education, relationship building, and then also that postnatal care is much easier. The discussions, the understanding, the trust, all of that, it makes it such a beautiful job that, yes, I mean, that's what I was yearning for, and having moved around, wasn't able to achieve everywhere I went. But hearing that it exists is rather lush, I must say.
But also for the safety aspect of it.
Yeah.
You know, I feel so much safer looking after a woman who I have known, and I know her family, and I know her history, and I know what she wants, and I can tell if she's not acting the normal way that she acts. So you pick up on things so much quicker that, you know, you very rarely get to a complication that has to be managed in the home setting, because you'd pick it up so much sooner. And even if you do, you know, as you were saying, it's a completely different way of approaching it, because you're actually approaching it from a principle level, not a flowchart level. You kind of has to happen in this scenario. How can I do it in this scenario, which is usually very different to how you would do it in hospital when you press the buzzer and the circus comes in and the lights go on and it all gets, you know, crazy. And I actually feel safer at a home birth in those circumstances than I do in a big obstetric unit with a button and obstetricians and paediatricians outside the door.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's like, you know, you're right. Just knowing the person you're looking after that's in front of you when they're in labour, it makes a massive difference. And I've been really, really lucky. I mean, I guess what I want to say as well is the fact that we're not expected to be on call 24/7. So within my, I'm part of a team of four midwives in my team, and we all take it in turn. So we all do an average of about 2 official on calls a week to cover our team. So it's not too bad. Now, that on call, when we're on call, because of course we don't have a triage service, so we get called for everything. So yeah, it could be, you know, women ringing with bleeding, or they might have reduced movements, or they might just, you know, be feeling a little bit anxious about something, and they just want to talk to somebody on the phone. And those calls can come at midnight, they can come at 3 a.m, they can come at 6, you just don't know. But we're also on call for them postnatally. And I will often go out at 3 a.m. to somebody who needs support with breastfeeding, and, you know, sit with them for 2 hours if that's what they need. So, you know, our on calls can be really quiet. Like, we don't always get a call every time we're on call, but they can be really busy. You can be up all night, just not necessarily looking after someone in labour, but just dealing with kind of like whatever is needed. But that's so important, and I love doing that. And I don't feel pressured with that, because I know that I'm probably going to be working the next day, but that's fine, because all my clients understand that I work an on-call system. I just ring them and say, really sorry, I need to go to bed today. Can we just reschedule? Yeah, that's fine. You know, because I've got that relationship with them, and that's okay. And I haven't got to worry about what other kind of work is in the main diary, because that's all to do with my colleagues and their clients. I've only got to worry about my clients. So it makes it a lot easier from that respect. So, you know, it is manageable. Some of us will go on call for our own clients, and we have got that flexibility to do that when they are due to give birth, if we want to, and we just let our teammates know. Like, for me, that's something that I choose to do, is to be available if I can for the women that are in my caseload that are going to give birth in the community. We can't follow them into the obstetric units because of, you know, we're not part of those health boards, so we can't insurance wise look after them and stuff there, and it would also, that would take us out of county, so we're then leaving our service short as well, if you like, for any women that are giving birth locally. So so yeah, I choose to, and I've been really lucky because I've kind of facilitated births now of whole families. You know, I've done many, you know, 2 babies in the family, and there's been a couple, because they've been really quick at having babies, I've done 3 now. So yeah, that's great, and I love that.
That's great. Can I ask a question, which, because you are the first man in the cauldron,
am I? And privileged.
You are indeed. 2023, we got there, baby.
Yeah, it.
I want to segue, and I just want to ask you about whether you had any challenges, or you found it challenging, being in such a profession that is heavily led and ran by women predominantly, and how you were received also in a small kind of rural context in Mid Wales.
Yeah. So, like, when I first, I guess I was used to it. I was used to, like, questions being asked about being a man in a woman's environment, if you like, because when I was a nurse, I went, after qualifying as a nurse, straight into a gynae ward, which had like an early pregnancy unit attached to it, because I knew obviously that was where I was going to go. And I actually got more, I don't know, like, questions asked or eyebrows raised by working as a male nurse on a gynecology ward, women's health ward, than I ever have done as a midwife working kind of, you know, obviously with mostly women. And when I qualify. Now, when I went to do my midwifery training in Oxford, they had already had a kind of culture of male midwives, so that I think I was like their fourth. Mm-hmm. And one of our lecturers, he was a midwife, so there was never really any kind of, people were just used to it. And then when I moved jobs, they kind of already knew me anyway. When I came back down to Wiltshire, they already knew me because, I forgot to say right at the beginning, I was actually, before I even became a nurse, I went and worked as a healthcare assistant in the local maternity unit. So they remembered me from way back then. again, that was fine. You know, they were really happy to have me and I was happy to be there. And then when I came to Wales, nobody said anything, but I don't know whether they kind of raised some eyebrows before I got there. Perhaps they did. I don't know. I've been very, I was welcomed, very well received, I think. It's been fine. As far as the women are concerned, I've never had a situation where somebody's turned around to me and just said, I don't want you purely because you're a man. It's generally because of cultural reasons. There might be certain religions as well where the women prefer to have female, professionals looking after them. And I guess as well, there are just some people that perhaps it's not my gender. It's like anything, you just don't make that relationship. And that's really important to recognize that. And I'm never ever offended if anybody turned around to me and said, I'm really sorry, but I would prefer to have a female look after me for whatever reason. That's completely fine. I'd rather them tell me than, particularly as well in labour, go into them and be very uncomfortable, be very uncomfortable, because that's going to detriment their labour, isn't it? They're not going to labour, effectively if I'm there as a presence that they really don't feel comfortable with. So, but it's very few and far between, really rare.
Good. Do you know, I did my midwifery honours on male midwives.
Did you?
I did.
Well, I wanted to ask this question. I thought she'd come in with that.
Can you remember this?
Yeah, I remembered you did that.
Yeah. And so it ended up being a thesis and it had three chapters. And there was only one, we were in a direct entry midwifery training, and there was only one male midwife. Can you remember? He's like a couple of years behind us. He wasn't in our year. And he'd apparently got out of the library and then got really annoyed with it and said I was man-hating, feminist, blah, blah, blah. But I don't think he read the whole thing. I think he might have just read chapter one. So chapter one was about kind of the 17th, 18th century male midwives, which were actually more like obstetricians. So it was about that. And it was about, all of that business. And then the second chapter was about equality in the workplace, like in terms of progression in careers. And as we know, men progress through careers in all realms. So it was basically saying, a male midwife is more likely to end up a manager than a female midwife. That's what the research says. But then the final chapter was about, well, what do women think about this? And what is the experience of? And basically, in summary, it was that if you ask some women before they had a male midwife, they would say, oh, no, I'd rather not have a male midwife. But actually, it wasn't about the sex of the midwife. It was about the care that was given by the midwife. Yeah. It was about the type of care they received that was way more important than, anything like that. So that was the final chapter, which you obviously didn't get to the final chapter, I don't think.
Wow, that's so interesting. I'd love to read that.
I'll send it to you. It's probably not great. It was like, 20 years ago, and I was but I'll send it to you if you're interested.
Yeah, definitely. I'd love to read it. I guess as well, it's relationship building, because I like, for the area that I cover now, I've covered it for 7 years since I've been out here. So I am the midwife for, my all the villages and stuff that I cover. I can be driving through and I'll just wave at people as I'm driving past, or they'll stop and have a chat to me and I'll look at their, child that's just growing so fast. And it just time just flies, isn't it? In this job, it makes you feel like your life's flashing before you. You just become like I guess, a little bit of a pillar of the community, and it's great, and I love that, and the fact that I can serve the same families over and over again. And now I'm at the point where even where somebody might phone to book in my area that's having their first baby, they will know somebody who's had me because of how tightly knit the community is. So I'm, you know, it's quite nice work. And that's the same for all my colleagues in all of their areas. You know, they become the midwife of that area, and you just build up those kind of relationships. So yeah, it's you know, I'm really privileged to be able to do that. And you know, I was only I had one of my clients birthed on Christmas Day, and it was her third baby, and I've looked after her for all of her babies. And I remember when she first came to me for her first booking appointment, and we had that little bit of a discussion around kind of place of birth options. You know, she was just like, oh my god, I'm going to hospital, I need to be in a hospital, I need that epidural, I'm not doing, you know, there's no way. And she ended up having two water births in our birth center, and she's just had the last one at home in a pool on Christmas Day in front of the Christmas tree. It was just the most like magical experience ever. And you know, like as we discussed earlier, at no point have I had to kind of worry about, question anything. You know, I know her so well, I know her family so well. It just works. You know, I just, for that third birth, I just walked in that house because I've done all of her, or most of her antenatal care at home anyway, because that's what we tend to do, is home antenatal care, unless the women want to come to the birth centre to be seen for appointments, but that's generally what we do anyway. So to be able to just walk into that home, I just looked at her and I was like, yeah, she's in labour. I know exactly how she acts in labour. I know exactly what she needs to labour effectively. And I just sit back. I have a cup of tea. I talk to her husband about his day and what he's been getting up to. Her mum's sorting out her other two little kids. And, you know, it just works. And, it's just that relationship-based care. And, you know, I get families and they'll offer to cook me dinner. They'll kind of, you know, it's more about, it's not just about giving midwifery care. It's about everything that goes with it, you know. And sometimes you'll sit and you'll have a cup of tea with somebody just because they want to have a chat, you know. And
that's when you learn.
Yeah, absolutely. You learn so much. And I went to see one of my ladies last week, and her partner, they've just had their first baby. They had, it was an induction, which I felt was probably the best decision because she was poorly. She was poorly with her blood pressure. But I still needed to spend 2.5 hours with them on that first postnatal visit to unpick everything. Because we all know what inductions are like. And although I feel that induction was probably the best thing for her, because of her clinical situation, it was still not fun for her. And we had to spend an hour just where they could debrief, and then an hour for me to try and then, you know, support them with, well, you know, this probably happened because of that, this happened because of that, this wouldn't have happened if you'd had your baby in a water pool at home. Because right up until the last minute, that's what we were planning. They would kind of come to the birth centre and have their baby in a pool. And then, of course, the cascade happened, as it does with an induction. So I guess then at the end of it, they're probably, not in so many words, but trying to say to me, thank God we went in, because... Well, look what would have happened if we had have been at your birth centre. And actually, it's trying to make them understand the wider context of that. Because I want them to come back to me next time feeling confident that they could have their baby with me and not feel terrified. Although I do feel it was one of the very few times someone's induced where I feel that it was probably a good idea. And then we spent a good probably 40, 45 minutes getting breastfeeding sorted, because by this point she's day 3 now. And, well, yeah, we won't even go there. But, you know, this is
the classic, isn't it? You've had intervention, therefore it's going to interrupt the breastfeeding. But that's the thing with the postnatal services. particularly for me, because that's my real passion area, is that it is always overseen. And in these, in a continuity of care model, or where you can just, you know this family, you know this woman, it's also having that time to be able to do the debrief. And it's not just get in, weigh the baby.
No.
Your breast fine? Yep, good, great. Oh, baby's pooing, weeing, tick, 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 tick. All of that debrief, this is for me, again, where we are missing out, is we're having everything that's going on classically within our maternity systems. And then we're just like, tick and flick, another 10-minute, 15-minute appointment, maybe 20 minutes, and we're out the door to the next person. And it might even be in the home setting, but as that midwife, we've probably never been to the home setting before. And we're trying to look for other signs and ideas of what's going on, how are they coping, and trying to cope. There's the dog catcher.
The dog's been removed.
And just trying to get through that, and to have that ability to do that, to have that ability to, like you say, when you're on call, and to just sit and have a chat, or go and do a breastfeed at 3 a.m. because, my God, this is when we sit there trying to feed our babies and the tears come, and trying to absorb information. We might be online trying to find the what, why in the house. And then, of course, the general midwife will come normally at whatever, 9 to 4 the next day. And it's a completely different scenario. And I think there's a magic for me when you can work in this way of working that you're working. And you know, there are lots of midwives able to work in this. We have a job, and I can only describe it as magic, because there's this feeling deep within of this kind of, for me, deep gratitude and privilege that I'm there. And also that those relationships are unlike anything else. Like, it's just this magic in the ether kind of thing that, wow, I'm here and I'm witnessing this, and this is happening as it should. And actually, it's a rarity for most of us working in this sphere, which...
Yeah. And I think...
And it's also...
Sorry.
I was going to say, it's also lovely being part of a community, as you were saying, you know, that it's really back to that traditional midwife role, isn't it? That's your role within a community.
Yeah.
And it's a respected role, but there's mutual respect, because without the community, you wouldn't have that role. And just to be known... I loved that when I worked in a model similar to yours, not as rural, west end of Newcastle, so it's a little bit more densely populated. But it was, it was lovely to be the midwife. Midwife.
It's great. And, you know, we have quite a lot of elective student midwives that come out to us because they hear about our service from all over the UK. Good. And they want to come and spend those few weeks with us. And a lot of them are kind of like, you know, city-based midwives. They've only ever worked in London or Manchester or, you know, Liverpool or somewhere. And so they come out with us, and I've had several where we've had to stop in the road for sheep or cows that are crossing the road, and they're like, they get their phones out and they're like, oh my God, you know, they just
that would have been me.
I'm not stuck in like a 2-hour traffic jam. I'm stopped because we've got like hordes of sheep crossing the roads, or they're, you know,
idyllic.
That's really, it's great for them. And actually, on the student side of things, it's particularly the elective students that come out to us, you know, they come out often in their third year, never having seen a truly physiological birth where a woman's on, you know, on her knees, acting in her own instinct, you know, in a pool of water, and that they're gobsmacked. They are, because they've just never seen it. And then I'm gobsmacked because they've never seen it, and they're about to qualify. And I just think, how are we ever going to sustain true, authentic midwifery if we aren't training true authentic midwives anymore? And it's not that, you know, don't get me wrong, it's absolutely not their fault. They can't help what they're exposed to and what they're seeing. That's the system we're in. But that worries me. That worries me for the future of midwifery. And I do feel like, dare I say it, that we're moving into the realms of obstetric nursing. And that concerns me a lot. So I really urge student midwives to come out and work with us if they can, even just for you know, a week, just to come and see. Even if you don't see a birth in that week, because I can never guarantee it, just to see all the other aspects of it that enable that woman to have a better chance of having, you know, that physiological birth. It's worth doing, definitely.
I'm really glad you said that as well, particularly even if you don't see a birth, because it is those things either side of the birth that actually make the birth the experience it is.
Yeah.
And it's very easy for us to get focused on this one event, but actually it's all those little events leading up to it where they've had interaction with someone they know and trust.
Yeah. And it's like, just as I was saying about the postnatal lady that had the induction, you know, I'm now trying to kind of build those bridges now, build those blocks so that when she has a baby in the future, if she does, she's coming back into that pregnancy empowered and believing in herself and not, you know, believing that it has to be, you know, traumatic with lots of things going on. So, yeah.
And that's hugely important work. Still important work that you're doing postnatally. It's not just, oh, well, it's just the postnatal, have a cup of tea, it's easy. That's instilling that confidence for the next time. I'm just looking at Rachel. Sometimes I'm like, is she got a question? Sometimes she freezes her internet's really good, James, and she does this. And then we're not sure whether she's still there or she's thinking. So I check.
I was just going to ask James if he thinks he'll stay there, if he'll be an old community midwife out there.
Oh, do you know why? It's hard to know. I don't know. I'd like, at the moment, I'd like to think I would, but I've got my own kind of thoughts and feelings about how I'm prepared to practice and how I'm not prepared to practice. And I guess if things changed too much because of the way things are going with midwifery in general, I guess then there might come a point where I have to say, just for my own kind of, you know, ethos and morals, no, I'm not prepared to do that now. No, you know, but we'll just have to see, won't we? I have been watching closely the independent midwives. They have got an insurance package now to provide intrapartum care the UK again. So it's fairly new. So I'm just watching this space just to see if how that goes. Although I love working where I'm working and it is a really good service, I do worry that if too many changes come in, it will become a place where actually ethically, for me personally, I can't work anymore because you've got to be true to yourself, haven't you, and what your own kind of, you know, ethos is on things, and that will never leave me. I came into this job for a reason, into this, not job, this lifestyle for a reason, and that will always stick with me, definitely. So we will see. Watch this space. But I'm happy for now.
I think I want to come and do a week working with you, James.
Yeah, come on. We'd have a great time. It'd
be lovely. And then I could come to the small holding as well.
Get hands on. And that's the other thing. You know, I think that what really helps me is, and actually a lot of my colleagues, because a lot of my colleagues are either in farming themselves or they're married to farmers. So we're seeing mammalian birth. And we see it happening all of the time. Okay, the mechanisms are slightly different, but the essentially it's the same thing. You know, the cocktail of hormones have to be the same. Like, you know, when we've got our sheep lambing, if I go in there, turn all the bright lights on and start messing around when a sheep is lambing, she's going to stop and we're going to end up with all sorts of complications. So actually, to understand that they need that kind of, you know, privacy, darkness, quietness, they take themselves off on their own, away from the rest of the flock, you know, that's exactly what a woman needs to be able to give birth. I mean, it's not rocket science, is it? It's just, it's nature, it's how it's always been and it always will be. And it doesn't matter how many machines or bits of technology we put on women and their babies, you're never going to get away from that. You know, you're just going to cause more problems in the process. Yeah.
That is lush. Thank you. I just wondered whether we could put in maybe a little story. Are you able to tell a story? Would you?
Yeah.
A story.
Can you tell me a story? That would be
really
nice.
Jack and Ori, tell a story.
Oh, Jack and Ori. Oh, I love that. Should I do illustrations as well to go with it?
Do you mean like a birth story?
Yeah. Nice. Okay. A nice, like, a bit of oxytocin lifting story.
See, she wants to end positively.
I want an oxytocin. I want to have some tears. I want oxytocin. Come on, bring it to me.
Okay. That's really hard to think because it sounds strange to some people, but because I see that all the time, it's hard to pinpoint one particular. Yeah, I can do one. That's fine. Yeah. Do you want the stats?
Tell us the stats first.
So one thing I wanted to mention as well is we offer home assessments in labour to everybody. So because even the women that are, you know, choosing an obstetric-led unit to birth, because they're so far away, unless they've got really kind of, you know, high risk issues, I guess, where it might be better that they just go straight there because of timings and stuff. Mm. Generally speaking, they know they can bring their on-call midwife who will come out to them first at home, do a full kind of like holistic home birth assessment. So not home birth, sorry, labor assessment, so that they, you know, they can at that point then make their decision about place of birth. So, and I think that's really important as well, is that we are able to do that because women change their minds on the day. Mm-hmm. You know, I've had several that have always been planning to go to the birth center or go to the obstetric unit, and they take one look at me and I'm like, you're doing amazing, you're doing really well. And they'll look at me and they'll go, well, I'm not getting in that fucking car now and driving an hour. And they'll have and I'll just get my kit in and we'll have a home birth, because we all carry our kits with us all the time. It's not a case of, right, you know, the home birth kits based at the birth centre, I've now got to go there and get it. We've got it, because,
and you have to have booked in for the home birth 20 weeks before, because we all need to be planned and ready. Amazing.
And we don't have to do all these ridiculous home birth risk assessments, because we're risk assessing throughout the whole pregnancy anyway. So it works. But equally, you get some women that have planned that home birth and you go out and see them and they're like, Jesus, get me in for an epidural now. And that's fine. Of course, if that's what they
but
want.
That's choice.
What they want to do. Often that doesn't happen because at that point they're transitional and they're going to push a baby out anyway. Yeah. But it's, you know, it's up to them. These stats were taken from 2021, because obviously we haven't done all of 2022 yet, because we've just finished 2022. So 2021, 15% home birth rate.
Wow. And what is it nationally?
Or is it like 2 or 3%?
Is it even that?
Probably not. Yeah. So that's home births. Our birth centres, which remember are still community-based births because they're not attached to any obstetric unit, that was another 14%. So a total community birth rate was 29% of our caseload.
1 in 3.
Transfer rates, 11% in labour, 6% postnatally, so 17%. Kind of in total. And the majority of our transfers are for a perceived delay in labour, because of course the guidelines don't really, well, they can't, can they? They can't be realistic for women, because particularly for first-time mums, why the hell are we transferring, you know, so many first-time mums for this perceived delay in labour? The women haven't got it wrong, have they? It's the guidelines.
Yeah, exactly. Rachel, can I just ask, that seems low to me, 11% transfer rate. What is the average around home births? Is it something sitting around 35% or?
Oh, God, I can't remember. I know that it's pretty high for primates. It's something ridiculous, like 40% last time I looked.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. 45.
Yeah. Out of all of those transfers, not that there were that many, but out of the transfers we had to do, 4.8% of them were what you would class as like a genuine like emergency, if you like, a need to go somewhere. Quick. But the outcomes were good. Nobody had, you know, a poor outcome either for mum or baby, despite the fact of our you know, the journey times we're dealing with. Do you want some breastfeeding rates, Katie?
Well, I would, yeah.
So at birth, 87.3%.
Wow.
That's impressive for Wales as well, particularly.
By 10 days, 72.4%.
Wow.
6 weeks, obviously we do get a drop, 48.6%. But I still think that's higher, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
And 6 months, 43.6%.
Wow.
Cool. That's good.
I mean, it makes perfect sense. Physiological birth, things tend to go more simple. And then what happens around 6 weeks and everything, it's all the other compounding factors that come in. But there's still this high rate at 10 days is, it doesn't surprise me, to be honest, but it's bloody marvellous. So, yeah. Thank you.
It's really good. And out of all of our births, so the ones that are included in the women that go to obstetric units, we still have a 67% vaginal birth rate and an instrumental birth rate of 9%. Elective cesarean sections were 12% and emergency cesarean sections were 12%. And we don't have any influence on those women once they hit that obstetric unit. They kind of fall out of our care.
That's incredible.
So that's where we are.
Marvellous. It just shows, doesn't it? That, I mean, the research supports it. All three of us here have worked in this type of model and experienced it, and it works. We just are not able to facilitate this for some reason.
We need more midwives that are authentic midwives. That's what we need to start with, I think, so that each midwife can have a smaller amount of women.
And we need more midwives who are able to witness working in this, so there isn't fear coming into this kind of job, so that there is a confidence when they come in, and then an enjoyment and this, you know, the satisfaction that then leads them to want to keep working for this, to keep, you know, shouting that we need this kind of system as well.
Definitely.
So, James, can you lead us out with a story that will bring tears to my eyes, please?
That's really putting him on the spot.
I know, kidding.
Can I tell you about, I'll tell you about a family that, this is a separate family to the one I was talking to you about a moment ago, who I drew a very close relationship to throughout all of her pregnancies. So, they've been a very prolific family. They've had four babies, been all very closely together. And the first baby, when she was pregnant, I wasn't working for the health board at that point. So I actually booked her for her second baby. And her first baby, she'd had a home birth, just purely because it was the simple fact of the midwife had gone out to do a home assessment and she was almost ready to birth. So she stayed at home and had a home birth. It wasn't really planned, but it happened and she was happy with everything. So I booked her for her second pregnancy. And, you know, straight away she was very keen for to stay at home this time. So, you know, when the time came, I got there, and typical second baby, I don't even think I managed to get a pair of gloves on. The baby was coming. So, but that was lovely, because I then said to her, do you want to catch a baby? Because I hadn't even got anything, you know, not that I need anything, but she said yes. So as the baby's shoulders birthed, she just put her hands down and she was on her sofa and she just lifted her baby up and just put her baby on her chest, and there they stayed for forever, basically, as long as they needed to. And I had her husband in the back. He was just behind her holding her hand, because he had the toddler in his arms, because she wouldn't go to bed. So you know, that was really nice. The whole kind of family were there and it was lovely. Then she came back for her third pregnancy, and again we had planned a home birth. So you can imagine by this point, I'm really getting to know them now, and we're just like, you know, having a great time talking about everything. And she came to me once towards the end of that pregnancy. She was like, I'm really itchy. My hands are really itchy. And I was like, okay, right, well, we'll do a little blood test. And that blood test came back slightly raised for bile acids, like by 1 or 2 points, I think, raised. So I said, well, look, technically this by the guidance, it means that you've probably got cholestasis. And the advice is now that I give you a referral to an obstetrician so you can talk about what you want to do moving forward. And she was probably about 38 weeks pregnant at this point. So she went in and she saw an obstetrician. And I remember being in Tesco and she phoned me and was like, I need to talk to you. They're trying to tell me that I've got to have my baby induced and I don't feel comfortable. I don't want to do this. And I said, then don't. You don't have to do anything. Get them to give you the actual statistics of what the actual increased risk is of your baby having, you know, a poorer outcome based on what your levels are at the minute, bearing in mind they're only very mildly raised. So that's what she did. And she came away having had a repeat blood test because she wasn't happy with what they were telling her. She didn't feel like she'd had time to process anything. They were just saying, you know, strangers that she'd never met before, saying to her, right, we need to induce you now, here, now, there, let's do this, you know, your baby's at risk of this, that and the other. So fair play, she came away from that and actually her repeat blood levels were right back down and she stopped itching. So then she went into labor and had her baby at home again, which was, you know, lovely, you know, really positive experience for her. And then she came back a fourth time. And so I'd obviously by this point looked after her for 2 pregnancies. And this fourth time she said, I really want a water birth. I haven't had a water birth yet. And I said, fine. Well, if you want to stay at home again, then hire a pool and we'll do a water birth at home. And yeah, that's what she did. And again, she caught her own baby. And by the point that I'm going in for the, you know, her fourth birth, my third time with her, I just know what she's doing by looking at her. And I, you know, we're not doing vaginal examinations, we're not doing all the messing around, we're just sitting in a corner observing, using midwifery skills, being quiet and, you know, watching and waiting. And yeah, this baby was born in the pool. And again, she got to lift the baby up and put him on. It was her first boy. She'd had 3 girls. So she put him on her chest and yeah, there they stayed. Gosh. And her placentas were physiological. She didn't need stitches for any of her babies. It's just an example of continuity of care that I can give you of how it can work and how, you know, wonderful it can be. And I've been doing this 14 years now and I still get emotional at a birth. I can't help it. I still get that little lump in my throat, tear in my eye. And the day that I don't get that will be the day that I stop.
That's lush.
There we are.
Thanks, James. Oh, yeah, that lump in the throat is, I was never good at holding that one back. And then when the tears of the partner come, I'm like, I need to go somewhere else and dry my eyes because I'm a goner. And when the baby reaches out and just starts to make the crawl and that first feed, that gets me. I did get an oxytocin release. Thank you very much. I feel very yummy now. I think
thank
we have
goodness
talked
for that.
It's fine. It's good. Job done. Excellent morning for a Monday. Thank you very much. James, it's been a real delight to have you in the cauldron and to just talk about midwifery when I feel it's good midwifery, it's real midwifery, and it's what a lot of us come into it to aspire to work like and to be like. And there are a huge amount of challenges going on right now. And it's been really nice to hear the positive side. And I think we all needed a boost for the new year. So I'm really grateful that you came and joined us.
Oh, thank you. I'm so glad to have been invited on. Thank you for having me. And I hope that I have given, you know, midwives out there a boost that it can be different. And yeah, there are models of care that work, and they work well for women and for midwives. Thank you. I've loved it.
Thank you.
Well, wasn't that a feel-good episode? Whilst I've still got you, because I know you're waiting for the bloopers... What? You've never heard those? You've never listened to the end before? Oh, you've got some backtracking to do. But before you go, if you have enjoyed this episode, please do go and share it on your socials. But also, a really important point is please go and rate us and write a review, particularly on Apple Podcasts. This is super important to keep the podcast getting out to those who need it most. Lately, we have had the best and most nicest, that is not English, Katie, DMs on Instagram, and I bloomin' love them. But we haven't had many reviews on podcast hosting platforms. I know it takes a bit longer, but this really, really helps us. So please do pop on over if you haven't already, and we really appreciate it. And so do those who get to hear this podcast. I want to mention that you can also support the show with a donation through the link in our bio on Insta. I don't half love me a cup of coffee. And thank you so much to those of you who do and have supported the show. Also, pop on over to my new website and sign up for my offerings, which are coming very, very, very soon. If you're on my email list, you will get the first dibs on discount codes for my new course. That's got to be a good reason to sign up, huh? And let's not forget my good friend, Dr. Reed. Go over and say hello to Rachel too. She's got an incredible collective you should definitely check out. All links are in the show notes, as always, and over on our Instagram page. So all I've got to say now is thank you for being with us, and we'll see you next time. And as always, here's the bloopers.
I don't know.
Probably. What? How many years have you been there and you're in the part of Wales where they speak bloody Welsh?
I don't know, I did
bloody Welsh, man.
I did evening classes for like a term, if you like, because I wanted to try and learn, and oh my god, I got myself so confused. But I learned the Welsh alphabet so that I could pronounce the words, because I thought, well, at least if I can do that much.
Exactly, the double L's.
Yeah, but no, I was never very good at, like, but actually we're not very Welsh speaking around here.
Really?
Not where we are, no, definitely.
Really,
if you go more north, yeah, there are. We have obviously Welsh speaking midwives as well, but yeah, it's not.
I know all the words on the M4, Araf, slow,
yeah.
Gwasanaethau, like services,
yeah.
Or hotel. They're the words I know in Welsh. That's how I learn my Welsh.
Between us, we could try and put together a Welsh lesson.
Absolutely. I think it's going to
be your next
body
online
language.
Course.
Yeah.
Do all the Welsh words for Welsh. Breastfeeding.
I'll be calling you up, James. I think I'm on my own there.
It's just little old me. I'm just a little midwife who works in the middle of nowhere.
There's no such thing as just.
No, exactly.
Now you'll have to tell Katie how to say your surname, because I have no idea either.
Boughton.
Ah, Boughton.
There you go.
How were you going to say it?
Boughton.
There we are.
Oh yeah, right.
Yeah, of course it was.
You have to do on call.
Yes. Yeah. Like sometimes.
Don't miss that.
You don't miss it. I love it. I get more upset if I miss my client's birth than I do about like being on call for them.
Wondering which of my courses is for you? Breastfeeding and Lactation, The Fundamentals has been designed for everyone working in the birthing field or those on their journey to becoming breastfeeding specialists or IBCLCs. This course gives you 7 hours of CPD and is packed with reflective learning, case studies, and some pretty tough at times quizzes to make sure this stuff sticks. It also means you can meet me monthly in my live Q&A. This is my course that I hope will fill in the gaps that traditional breastfeeding education has left out. I want you completing this, feeling confident to support any breastfeeding or lactation challenge of those in your care. But wait, I have another course called The Feeding Couch. Who's this for? Currently, around 80 to 96% of women decide to breastfeed during their pregnancy, but by just 8 weeks after birth, a third to almost 50% of those women have stopped breastfeeding. And of those women who stopped, 80% say they stopped breastfeeding before they wanted to. Learning about breastfeeding during pregnancy has been shown to improve breastfeeding self-confidence and improve the rate of exclusive breastfeeding in the short and the long term. I believe every mum should be able to choose how she wants to feed her baby and for how long. Knowledge is power. That's why I created The Feeding Couch, designed to be watched during pregnancy or for new mums and parents who may be struggling right now with breastfeeding. The content is in step-by-step, binge-worthy whilst pregnant or for those most tired of days postpartum, totally easy to find exactly what you need and dip in and out when you need a breastfeeding answer quickly. And for you, beautiful podcast listener, there is a 10% discount off both courses when you use the code POD10, that's P-O-D-10, at checkout. To find out more, hop on over to my website, katiejames.site, and have a look at the incredible content waiting for your lucky peepers.